Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. It's very pleasing to see the place is full to the limits as the last people are finding the odd seats to take their place. I'm going to take a couple of moments just to introduce the speaker. This is the first of the... let me start again. It is still good to see you, even after I've caught my breath. I would like to say that it's been an interval of some years, and this is the first public event to be conducted by Darwin at LSE. Darwin at LSE is the group which has a home in the Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science, and that is exactly the place for a program that offers the power and insights of evolutionary theory to other disciplines, especially the social sciences. Today is the first of two public lectures that we've organized this year. Our second one is going to be by Professor Simon Baron Cohen of the Autism Research Center at Cambridge University, entitled, Is Autism an Extreme of the Male Brain? And that's on Tuesday the 15th. Of March, in about 3 weeks' time. By coincidence, or maybe not, Professor Simon Baron Cohen and I were both undergraduates at Oxford together, where we were students of Richard Dawkins, which is why I've been given the job of introducing the speaker this evening. I'm not sure what to say that you don't already know. Richard Dawkins has a long title, which is Charles Simonyi, Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford. It's a long name, but the list of awards and honors that he has is even longer, and I'm only going to pick two of them as an indication. Professor Dawkins is both a Fellow of the Royal Society and a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and I feel that's quite an impressive and rare combination. He's best known for his books, which have all stayed constantly in print, have won him a slew of awards, and which have been translated into an unfeasibly large number of languages, and I shall run through them quickly. Not the languages, that's the books. You could supply your own languages. The Selfish Gene in 1976 was his first, and this was followed by The Extended Phenotype, The Blind Watchmaker, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, A Devil's Chaplain, and The Ancestor's Tale. The Ancestor's Tale being his most recent book, and can strongly recommend this wonderful story of life. Richard Dawkins' lecture this evening is based on an idea raised towards the end of this book, and the title of his talk is Evolution Predictable? He set the tone for this remarkable body of work in The Selfish Gene, where he brought together the new evolutionary thinking of theoreticians like Bob Trivers, John Maynard Smith, Bill Hamilton, who at that time were not widely appreciated. Richard's clear and elegant writing articulated for the first time in an accessible form the coherent logic and radical implications of this new field. I'd like to say something quickly about Bill Hamilton, because you should know that not only was he possibly the greatest of the evolutionary theorists of the last century, but he did some of his most important work here at the LSE. People forget that the LSE has a long and fine tradition of sheltering evolutionary thinkers. Bill Hamilton was one of the first to identify altruism, the converse of selfishness, as a central problem for biology, which was radical. When in the early 1960s, as a nerdy postdoc, he wanted to explore the mathematical genetics of altruism and social behavior, nobody could imagine why. So it was greatly to the credit of the LSE that Bill Hamilton was given space here. This work led to the publication of his landmark 1964 papers on the genetical evolution of social behavior, which transformed the science and are now part of the canon of biology and increasingly of the social sciences. It was Richard Dawkins, more than anyone, who put these ideas into the public domain in The Selfish Gene. I am aware that Richard Dawkins is sometimes still misunderstood. For example, I'm told that there are still people who believe, quite wrongly, that he was saying that selfish genes are genes for selfishness. They make us selfish. In fact, one of his book's strongest messages is almost the opposite, that the selfishness of genes can lead to the evolution of unselfish behavior in living creatures such as ourselves. So selfish genes can enable us to be altruistic. I know that Richard Dawkins won't have minded my digressing onto the subject of Bill Hamilton. I do remember that when I was a student of Richard's and we hadn't done our homework and were lost for words at the beginning of our speeches, we would find any excuse to mention Bill Hamilton. It took only the slightest prompting, and off he'd go, rabbiting along for hours. And so, ladies and gentlemen, our speaker this evening, Professor Richard Dawkins.
Well, if we're trading stories about Oxford tutorials, I can't actually tell any good anecdotes about Richard, but I can tell one about next month's speaker, Simon Baron Cohen. It is true that I tutored him as well as Richard. And since it was my habit to rabbit, I sometimes would run over the hour, and so the next person to come in for the tutorial was kept waiting outside. And I was, as Richard says, rabbiting on one occasion. And then it was 5 minutes past the hour. Suddenly the door burst open, and in charge Simon Baron Cohen, saying, "No, I really can't agree with that last remark." Science sets great store by predictability in a theory. There's a memorable scene in Fred Hoyle's science fiction novel, The Black Cloud, one of the best, I think, science fiction novels ever written, although it has one of the most unpleasant heroes. In this novel, at one point, the scientist characters are wrestling with the extremely odd behavior of the black cloud, which has just appeared in the vicinity of Earth from outer space. Its response to radio transmissions is so weird that it could almost be a result of intelligent design. Most of the scientists, including the brilliant young physicist Dave Weikart, flatly refuse to believe that the pattern that they seem to have identified in the behavior of the cloud is a real pattern. They prefer to believe that it's a series of highly improbable coincidences. They argue back and forth in a post hoc way until Alexandrov, the Russian comic relief character, expostulates, "Bloody bad philosophy, waste of breath, hypothesis judged by prediction, only sound method." The hero, Christopher Kingsley, then puts this into practice. "I predict that my pattern A will be repeated. What I'd like to know is what Weikart predicts." Weikart didn't quite like the turn of the argument, and he attempted to hedge. "Come off it, Dave. What do you predict? Where do you put your money?" And Weikart was forced to admit that he put his money on Kingsley's prediction being wrong. So they all trooped off to test the prediction. Kingsley was right, and Weikart was wrong. Weikart speaks again. "But don't you see, Kingsley, that it's utterly mad?" Kingsley looked at his watch. "It's almost time to go and try again, if anyone wants to." "In heaven's name, no," said Lester. "Either we go or we stay, and if we stay, it means that we accept Kingsley's hypothesis. Well, boys, do we go or do we stay?" remarked Marlowe. "We stay." They stayed and discussed the implications of accepting this mad hypothesis whose predictions so surprisingly have been fulfilled. Again, Alexandrov puts it succinctly into words. "Bastard in cloud, said so before." Now, the point of the story is that the phenomena they've been observing were all along compatible with the hypothesis of intelligent design post hoc, but the scientists were rightly reluctant to accept such an outlandish hypothesis until they tested its predictions. Now, evolution has been suspected of not standing up too well in the prediction department. It appears to be a theory of history, and it's been said that you can't test historical theories by their predictions, because the events predicted are all in the past anyway. Well, that's a very naive interpretation of what prediction means. On the face of it, any historical science, such as astronomy, is vulnerable to it. But the answer is almost trivial. You can predict that if you examine the fossil record, you will find a certain pattern. The fossils, of course, have all been laid down in the past, but the prediction is a prediction about a future finding of a proposed paleontological investigation. Nobody's looked yet, so it's a real prediction of the future. J.B.S. Haldane implied as much in his famous riposte to a Popperian heckler who asked him what would falsify the theory of evolution. Fossil rabbits in the Precambrian. Maybe that's what I was rabbiting on about, you never know. The theory of evolution makes very specific predictions about where fossils should be found, and more particularly, where they should not be found. When creationists point to gaps in the fossil record, I think the best response is to begin by saying we're lucky to have fossils at all, and we'd be perfectly well off without them. But if, given that we've got fossils, evolution does not predict that there will be fossils in a particular place, though it's nice if there are. There could be just nothing. There could be gaps. Evolution makes the very strong prediction that there will be literally no fossils in the wrong place, anachronistic fossils where they shouldn't be on the geological timescale. Incidentally, there's also Michael Shermer's amusing point that if a creationist challenges you with a gap in the fossil record, and you obligingly fill that gap with a fossil, the creationist will come straight back at you with, "Now there are two gaps!" But we don't actually have to do this system of predicting the past in this rather indirect way. Life is not too short to make predictions experimentally about from the theory of evolution about what will happen in the true future. When you think about it, look at this here. This is a slide of artificial selection of maize plants selected for high oil content and low oil content. And you can see, I don't know whether the mouse is going to work. Does that appear on the screen? No, it doesn't look as though it does. Okay. The upper graph is a selection line over some 80 generations, maize plants being selected for increased oil content of their seeds, and there's an opposite line being selected for decreased. So that is a prediction that if you artificially select, if you put into practice selection of a Darwinian kind experimentally, you will get some such result as that. Now, that is artificial selection, not natural selection, and it could be written off as a completely different phenomenon, not relevant to the experimental testing of the predictions of the theory of natural selection. But actually, if you think about it, what else would an experimental test of natural selection look like, if not artificial selection? You are putting into the situation an artificial, an experimental administration of the very force which you believe is important in nature. But as a matter of fact, there is a little bit more we can do. John Endler is showing the way with his pioneering studies of guppies in the wild. John Endler studied guppies in streams in Trinidad and Venezuela, mountain streams. The streams form pools with waterfalls between them, and fish can't move, usually, up a waterfall. So these pools are isolated from the pools below them, except in freak flood years when the drop of a waterfall is reduced and occasionally a fish can get up a waterfall into a higher pool. That's what the guppies can do. there's an important predator, the pike cichlid, Crenicichla alta, which can't travel up a waterfall under any circumstances. It's confined to pools below the lowest waterfall in a stream. Now, Endler's observation was that if you look at the guppies in streams above the lowest waterfall, where there aren't any predators, the guppies are brightly coloured with spots, and they have various other characteristics, which are best interpreted as due to sexual selection. But if you look in the bottom pool, where there are predators, the guppies are drab, and they look well adapted to avoid predation. So that's the observation. And the hypothesis, of course, is that natural selection by predators has penalized bright colors where there are predators. Where there are no predators, sexual selection had free rein to produce bright colors. That's the observation. Could Endler test it experimentally? Could he test the prediction? Well, yes, in both the lab and the field. In the lab, which was a large greenhouse, Endler set up a set of 10 artificial ponds with gravel bottoms designed to mimic the natural ones. In every pond, he placed a mixed population of guppies containing all different colours from drab to brightly coloured. He allowed them to breed freely. He added cichlid predators to 4 of the ponds. To another 4 ponds, as a control, he added killifish, which prey only on juvenile guppies and are quite harmless to adult guppies, and the remaining 2 ponds had no predators at all. And the results you see in the graph after 14 months, which is 10 guppy generations, the pools, the artificial pools that had high predation were all drab, and the artificial pools that had no predation had all gone brightly coloured, as if by sexual selection. A similar test was done in the field. Endler took guppies from natural pools below the waterfalls, all of which were subject to predation and all of which were drab in colour, and he transplanted these guppies into a virgin pool above a waterfall where there were no guppies and no predators. 2 years later, he examined the population, which had been all drab. They were now well on their way to being brightly coloured. 9 years later still, David Resnick visited the pool and found that they were all brightly coloured and a whole cluster of other changes, which were the same changes that had been seen in the wild associated with lack of predation. The whole life history strategy, among other things, had shifted. So Endler and others have shown that we can test predictions from the theory of natural selection over the short timescale, the short time span of a human lifetime. But of course, that's not what most people mean by predicting evolution. When I give public lectures, I always try to answer questions at the end, and the commonest question by far is, what might humans evolve into next? The questioner always touchingly imagines it's a fresh and original question, and my heart sinks every time, for it's a question that any sensible evolutionist will evade. You cannot, in any detail, predict the future evolution of any species, except to say that the vast majority have gone extinct. But although we can't predict the future of any species, say 20 million years hence, there is a little we can do, and that's the main topic of my lecture today. The American theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman invented a thought experiment in which he imagined evolution rerunning again and again from the same starting point. Which properties of organisms would arise repeatedly? Which properties would be rare? Which properties would be easy to evolve? Which hard? Well, short of pure speculation, can we look at the history of life as it actually happened and get any sort of clue as to how to answer the Kaufman question? Are there any natural runs of the Kaufman thought experiment? Well, yes, there are, in a way. Through happy accidents of geographical isolation over the whole period when mammals were evolving after the dinosaurs went extinct. Australia, New Zealand, Madagascar, South Africa, and even Africa are kind of natural experiments. New Zealand is a special case because there weren't any mammals in those early days, and birds filled the mammal niches. But in the others, what we see is a common pattern of evolution, a common radiation of mammalian types, separately in Australia, Madagascar, South America, Africa, and indeed Asia. Africa is a bit of a surprise among those examples. It's only recently been realized from molecular evidence that there is a group of African mammals which really belong to Africa and which evolved there, and include, strangely, creatures like elephants, elephant shrews, dugongs, manatees, hyraxes, aardvarks, etc. I would never have thought, when I was a student, that elephant shrews would turn out to be closer cousins to elephants than they are to shrews. The Australian natural experiment is clearer cut. There were only marsupials. It just happened that a marsupial got into Australia early on, and from that original marsupial, maybe only a single species, maybe even a single individual, the whole of the radiation of Australian marsupials eventually appeared. The picture shows what looks like a dog. It's not a dog. It's a marsupial. No relation to a dog at all. Alas, it's now extinct. Here are three ways to be a mole, one from Africa, one from Australia, and one from Eurasia. You can predict that if mammals are given free rein to evolve in a continent, a virgin continent, some of them will probably specialize in digging for worms and grubs underground, and they will eventually come to look like moles, with stout spades for front feet, no eyes to speak of, a keen sense of smell and touch, and so on. This one, the one at the bottom, is a marsupial from Australia. The one at top right is our familiar mole, and the one at top left is an African mole, the golden mole, which is an afrothere, nothing to do with the other kinds of moles. Two ways to be a flying squirrel. The one on the left is a marsupial from Australia. The one on the right is a rodent from North America. We can predict that if mammals are given free rein to evolve in a virgin continent, it's quite likely that some of them will become flying squirrels. And they'll look like this. They'll look much more like each other, like the other ones in different continents, doing the same job, than they will look like their closer relatives in the same continent. Two ways to be a saber tooth, both of them extinct. On the left, we have the true cat saber tooth. On the right, we have the marsupial saber tooth, which lived in South America. Actually, there are at least three ways to be a saber tooth, because there are so-called false saber tooths, which used to live in North America. The differences can be revealing, too. Kangaroos are the Australian equivalent of antelopes, but they look very different because they've developed an entirely different way of getting about, which is bipedal hopping instead of quadrupedal galloping. Both ways of getting about are extremely impressive, extremely fast. Presumably, at some ancestral parting of the ways, either of the two, quote, experimental lineages could have taken either route. As it happened, the Australian ones went down the bipedal hopping route, and the placental ones went down the quadrupedal galloping route. And we now marvel at the multifarious differences between the end products. It would have been extremely hard to predict whether the large herbivores of Australia would go down the bipedal hopping route or the quadrupedal galloping route. The vacuum left by the dinosaurs freed the mammals to evolve in parallel on separate continents, and I've represented those separate evolutions as the equivalent of natural Kaufman thought experiments. The dinosaurs, too, in their time, had similar evolutionary radiations, not exactly the same, and there were notable omissions. I can find no answer to my question of why there seems to be no dinosaur mole, for example. Before the dinosaurs, there were yet other multiple parallels, notably among the mammal-like reptiles, and these too culminated in similar ranges of types. So we've reached an interim answer to the question about the predictability of evolution. After any major catastrophic extinction, we can't predict in detail what will fill the vacuum, but we can predict the range of types that are likely to arise. There'll be herbivores and carnivores, grazers and browsers, meat eaters, fish eaters, insect eaters. There'll be runners, flyers, swimmers, climbers, burrowers. The species won't be exactly the same as the ones we see today, or the parallel ones that evolved in Australia or South America, or as the dinosaur equivalents, or the mammal-like reptile equivalents. But there will be a similar range of types, making their livings in a similar range of ways. If, during the next million years, there's a major catastrophe and a mass extinction comparable to the end of the dinosaurs, we can predict a radiation of animal types similar to those that preceded the dinosaurs, similar to the dinosaurs themselves, similar to the separate radiations of mammals on different continents after the dinosaurs. But we can't predict what will be the ancestor that gives rise to them. If I were forced to guess, I might suggest rats, and I did so in one of the purple passages that I rarely permit myself in my books, in a passage from The Ancestor's Tale. I have a post-Armageddon vision. When even the four horsemen are laid low by the apocalypse, it will be rats that scavenge their remains, rats that emerge as the ultimate post-human scavengers. They gnaw their way through New York, London, and Tokyo, digesting spilled larders, ghost supermarkets, and human corpses, and turning them into new generations of rats, whose racing populations explode out of the cities and into the countryside. In a period of intense competition, short generations conspire with radioactively enhanced mutation rates to boost rapid evolution. With human ships and planes gone, islands become islands again, with local populations isolated, save for occasional lucky raftings. Ideal conditions for evolutionary divergence. Within 5 million years, a whole range of new species replace the ones we know. Herds of giant grazing rats are stalked by giant saber-toothed predatory rats. Given enough time, will a species of intelligent, cultivated rats emerge? Will rodent historians and scientists eventually organize careful archaeological gnaws through the strata of our long compacted cities and reconstruct the peculiar and temporarily tragic circumstances that gave ratkind its big break? That's partly lifted from Dougal Dixon's imaginative book, After Man, and here's his artistic pre-construction, I suppose we'd have to say, of a rat-descended, walrus-like animal. It's not at all implausible, by the way, that rodents could get big. This is a picture of a couple of fossil rodents, giant guinea pigs, from the fossil record of South America. The animal to the left is a real rhino. The animal, the grey animal to its right, is a gigantic rodent. And then we have a tapir and then a slightly smaller rodent, giant capybara. But we don't have to rely upon geographical separation to imagine something like the Kaufman experiment. We can think of the experiment of evolution being rerun, not from the same starting point in different geographical areas, but from different starting points, very possibly in the same geographical area. For example, the eye has evolved between 40 and 60 times independently around the animal kingdom. It seems that life, at least on this planet, is almost indecently eager to evolve eyes. We can pretty confidently predict that a sample of Kaufman reruns would culminate in eyes, and probably not just eyes in general, but specifically compound eyes, like those of an insect, a prawn, or a trilobite, camera eyes, like ours, or a squid's, colour vision, mechanisms for fine-tuning the focus and the aperture, very probably even parabolic reflector eyes, like those of a limpet, pinhole eyes, like those of Nautilus, that latter-day ammonite-like mollusk in a floating coiled shell. If there's life on other planets, it's a good bet that there will also be eyes, probably based on the same optical principles as the eyes we see on this planet. There are only so many ways to make an eye, and life on this planet may well have found them all. We can do the same kind of count for other adaptations. Echolocation, the trick of emitting sound pulses and navigating by accurate timing of the echoes. It's evolved at least four times in bats, toothed whales, oil birds, and cave swiftlets. Not as many times as the eye, but still often enough to make us think that it's a fair prediction that if the conditions are right, echolocation will evolve. And very likely, reruns of evolution would rediscover the same specific principles by which echolocation works, the same tricks for confronting difficulties. It would repeatedly evolve using very high-pitched cries, because you get better resolution of detail with high than low-pitched. The cries in at least some species are likely to be frequency-modulated, swooping down or up in pitch, because early parts of each echo are then distinguishable from late parts by their pitch. The computational apparatus in the brain might very well make subconscious calculations based on Doppler shifts in frequency of echoes, for the Doppler effect is certainly universally present on any planet where there's sound, and bats make sophisticated use of the Doppler effect. How do we know, by the way, that something like the eye or echolocation has evolved independently? Well, we do it by looking at the family tree. Relatives of oil birds and cave swiftlets don't do echolocation. Oil birds and cave swiftlets have therefore evolved the trick independently. Each has independently taken up life in caves, and so they needed to. They evolved the technology independently of bats and whales, clearly, since nothing else in the surrounding family tree does that trick. We don't know how many more times echolocation evolved. Some shrews and seals have a rudimentary form of the skill, and actually so do some blind humans. Did pterodactyls do it? Did ichthyosaurs do it? They look like dolphins, presumably made their living in a similar way to dolphins. Dolphins, we know, make heavy use of echolocation, so perhaps ichthyosaurs did too, in the days before there were any dolphins. There's no direct evidence. We have to remain open-minded. One point against is that ichthyosaurs have extremely large eyes, and that might suggest they relied on vision instead of echolocation. Whales have, and dolphins have very small eyes. Like any zoologist, I can search my mental database of the animal kingdom and come up with an estimated answer to questions of the form, how many times has X evolved independently? And I think it would make a good research project to do the counts more systematically. I've done them rather anecdotally. I imagine that some X's will come up with a many times answer, as I's do, and some will come up with quite a few times, like echolocation, some with perhaps none at all. How many times has the sting evolved, venomous injection, hypodermic injection of venom? Well, I've made a list of all that I can think of. Other zoologists and botanists may come up with others. Jellyfish, spiders, scorpions, centipedes, insects, snakes, lizards, stingrays, teleost fish, mammals. The duckbill platypus has a poisonous sting in its the male duckbill platypus in its hind claw, and stinging nettles. How many times has electrolocation evolved, the trick of using weak electric fields for navigation? Well, duckbill platypuses do something a bit similar, but it's best evolved in electric fish, independently in two quite separate families of electric fish, the New World Gymnotus, the Old World Gymnarchus are the ones pictured there. They both of them generate an electric field. They then detect distortions in the electric field, which indicate obstacles, possibly prey, in the vicinity. In order to do this, it's essential that the fish's body should be straight and rigid. The fish cannot indulge in the sinuous curves of the body that any ordinary fish uses to swim. That would completely mess up the electric fields. They couldn't use them for finding their way about. So what they do is keep the body rigid, but they have a single long fin running the whole length of the body, and that is the thing that passes waves like the whole body of another kind of fish. The fascinating thing is that in the New World ones, this long fin is on the belly side, the ventral side of the body, whereas in the Old World, the African ones, the long fin is on the dorsal side. Just a trivial difference to bring home the fact that these fish have invented the trick entirely independently. It is not a certain bet, but one could make a tentative prediction that it's not unlikely that in Kaufman reruns of evolution, we shall get electrolocation. How many times has flight evolved? True flapping flight has evolved 4 times. In insects, pterodactyls, birds, and bats. I would predict that flight would probably re-evolve in thought experimental reruns of evolution. Numerous examples exist, not of true flapping flight, but of gliding. Those are just 4 examples there, but they include lizards, frogs, snakes, flying fish, squids, colligos, marsupials, rodents twice, etc. So I think we put a lot of money on a prediction that in Kaufmannian reruns, gliding would evolve. Jet propulsion has evolved twice, in squids who swim very fast by jet propulsion, and in scallops who swim rather more slowly by a totally different mechanism. So it's, again, almost certainly independently evolved. What about things that have evolved only once or not at all? The wheel, famously, it needed to be invented in human history. Has it ever evolved in nature? Apparently only once in bacteria. The picture shows a diagram of the axle and the molecular motor which rotates the flagellum of a bacterium, the flagellum being the hair-like, whip-like appendage with which it swims. It doesn't just wiggle it like a lizard wiggles its tail. It actually rotates. It's a true rotating bearing. And there is an actual little engine in there which keeps that axle rotating. It's surprisingly hard to think of good ideas, ideas like the wheel, which humans can identify as good ideas, that have evolved only once. I put the challenge to my Oxford colleague, George McGavin, the entomologist and naturalist. I said, can you think of any examples of something that's only ever evolved once? And he came up with a nice list, but it's still a short one compared, this I believe is significant, a short one compared with the list of things that have evolved many times. His first example is the bombardier beetle. What this beetle does is squirts a noxious and boiling hot liquid out of its rear end when threatened by an enemy. Because the liquid that it uses is noxious, corrosive, and boiling hot, it can't be stored in that form in the beetle. Instead, what the beetle stores is 2 precursors, 2 chemical precursors of the noxious liquid, and they're kept in separate, obviously, glands. When the beetle needs to deter an enemy, it squirts both these chemicals into a combustion chamber near its rear end. It explodes and shoots out of the back. This case is well known to creationists who love it. They think it's self-evidently impossible to evolve it by gradual degrees. because the intermediate stages would all have exploded. It's not as easy a problem to solve as your laughter suggests, although you may be way ahead of me. The trick is that the process needs a catalyst. Nothing happens if you don't have a catalyst. And so what the beetle must have done in history is to add the catalyst, increasing the catalyst a little bits at a time. I demonstrated this when I did the Christmas lectures for children. And I explained the whole story and I hammed it up a bit. And I put on a World War II helmet. And I said that anybody who was of a nervous disposition could leave the room, because I had here two bottles of the substances which explode when you add them to each other. And I put on the helmet, added them together, absolutely nothing happened. And so then I added a little bit, I did it again, but added a small amount of the catalyst, and then you got a little warming up. And then I did it again with a slightly more of the catalyst, and then there was quite a fizz. And then I added a lot of the catalyst, and then there was a whoosh, and there was a great smoke and steam and satisfactory round of applause. George McGavin's next example in his list is the archerfish, Toxotes. He thinks it's unique in shooting a missile, actually it spits water, to knock prey down from a distance. There you see a fish under the water, and it's aiming a jet of water at an insect well above the surface, knocking it down into the water where it eats it. There is no other example of an animal that does that. So far, anyway. The diving bell spider, Argyra nita, it lives and hunts entirely underwater, but like dolphins, dugongs, turtles, freshwater snails, indeed all land animals that have returned to water, it still needs to breathe air. But unlike those other exiles, Argyra nita constructs a diving bell under the water. It spins it of silk. Silk is the universal solution to any spider problem. And it attaches it to an underwater plant. The spider then goes to the surface to collect air, which it carries in the same way as some insects do, in a lair trapped by body hairs. But unlike those insects, which simply use the air to breathe while they're swimming with it, the spider takes the air down to the diving bell and offloads it into the diving bell. So it keeps pumping up the diving bell. And it then sits in the diving bell. That's where it sits and waits for prey. And when it catches prey, it stores them also in the diving bell. There doesn't seem to be any other example of that. But George McGavin's champion example is the larva of an African horsefly, Tabanus. This is a fascinating story. The larva lives in pools of water in Africa. Predictably, because when the dry season comes, the pools dry up. But before the pool dries up, the larva buries itself in the mud where it pupates and waits there. And then when the next rainy season comes, it comes out as an adult and flies off. Now, when mud dries, cracks tend to form in it. And this usually happens, and it's clearly a danger to the larva, which is buried in the mud. Wouldn't it be nice if the larva could find some way of preventing cracks from slicing it in two? Well, it does, in a truly wonderful and, again, probably unique manner. Before it buries itself in its own pupation chamber in the mud, it first corkscrews its way down into the mud with a cylindrical corkscrew pattern, then turns around and corkscrews its way back in the opposite direction, and only then does it dive into the mud in the middle between the two corkscrewed tunnels where it pupates. Now you see what this means, that the pupa, the larva, is now sitting in the mud, surrounded by a sort of cylinder of weakened mud where it spiraled its way down, first one way and then up the other. So when the cracks snake across the mud, when they reach this cylinder, they don't cut straight across. They take a bypass route around where the lava is. It's like the perforations around a stamp, which stop you tearing across the stamp. This seems to be unique to this one genus of horsefly. So we're not going to predict that in reruns of evolution, hypothetical reruns of evolution in our thought experiment, we're going to get another insect or another animal of any sort that does that. We're not going to predict that we're going to get another diving bell spider or another bombardier beetle. These have only happened once. You see, what I'm trying to build up a kind of statistical view of the likelihood that certain things will evolve and other things won't, the predictability of evolution. Are there any good ideas that we can identify that have never evolved by natural selection? Well, as far as I know, no animal has ever evolved an organ for the transmission or reception of radio waves for long-distance communication. Fire, too, seems to be unique to human technology. There are some plants whose seeds need fire to germinate, but that doesn't count. That's just simply exploiting fire when it's there. The use of metal for skeletal purposes would seem to be a very good idea, but it's never evolved, except in human artifacts. And perhaps it's impossible to achieve without fire. Might humans evolve twice, or something very like them? Prevailing orthodoxy emphatically says no. Simon Conway Morris, one of our leading paleontologists, bucks this trend and answers fairly decisively yes. The subtitle of his book, Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe, he means it in a sense which is not too far from literal. He really thinks that a rerun of evolution would result in a second coming of man, or something very like, perhaps a bipedal animal with hands, with eyes that look forward, with a big brain, with speech and intelligence, perhaps. Given that his thesis is so unpopular and unfashionable, he mounts a surprisingly coherent case. The two witnesses that he calls are convergence and constraint. Convergence has been the dominant theme of most of my lecture. Similar problems call forth similar solutions, not just twice or three times, in some cases 40 times. Well, I thought I was pretty extreme in my enthusiasm for convergent evolution, but I've met my match in Simon Conway Morris. He presents a stunning array of examples, many of which I hadn't met before. But whereas I usually explain convergence by invoking similar selection pressures, Conway Morris does that, but he also adds his second witness, constraint. The materials of life and the processes of embryonic development allow only a limited range of solutions to a particular problem. Given any particular evolutionary starting point, there's only a limited number of ways out of the box. So if two reruns of a Kaufman thought experiment would encounter anything like similar selection pressures, developmental constraints will enhance the tendency to arrive at the same solutions. So whereas I would always have invoked similar selection pressures to get to the same solution, he's adding, and I think it's sensible to do so, that living material, living tissue, living embryologies have only certain ways in which they can develop. And that will enhance the tendency for evolution to be predictable. I was struck by Conway Morris's use of the analogy of the predictability of the evolution of insects. The defining features of the insects are quite numerous. They are an articulated exoskeleton, compound eyes, a characteristic six-legged gait, in which three of the six walking legs are always on the ground, and thereby defining a triangle with two legs on one side, one on the other, and that keeps the animal stable. Respiratory tubes, known as tracheae, that serve to bring oxygen into the interior of the animal via special openings called spiracles down the side of the body. So instead of using blood to carry oxygen around, insects actually have the oxygen going in pipes hollow pipes of air. Also, not defining of insects, but found among insects strikingly, is the development of complex eusocial colonies, as in honeybees, ants, termites, and wasps. Well, now, all those features of insects seem pretty strange. One might imagine that all of them could be one-offs in the lottery of life. But on the contrary, all of them are convergent. All of them have arisen more than once independently. Well, of course, to say that they've all separately evolved independently is not to say that we're going to get all of them together on another rerun of evolution. But still, it doesn't seem to me to be absurdly improbable that we would get insects again if evolution were to be run a second time. I wouldn't say it's as strong as to call it a prediction that we'll get insects again. But in a way, Conway Morris is pushing the envelope, and I think that it's an interesting exercise that he's indulging in. I'm tempted by his belief that we should stop thinking of convergent evolution as a rarity to be remarked upon, to be marveled about when we find it. Perhaps we should come to see convergent evolution as a norm, and we should marvel when we find exceptions to it. And the conclusion to his argument, of course, is that if you can make that sort of argument for the predictability of getting insects, why not humans or something very like humans? Now, if evolution is indeed predictable, what drives it in predictable directions? Is there something progressive about the direction of evolution? Well, I want to make the case that the most compelling progressive force in evolution is the arms race. Progressiveness in evolution is another somewhat unfashionable topic, and it's one that I have advocated and I'm going to continue to advocate. The arms race is my leading contender, my leading candidate for a driving force that produces progressive evolution. The analogy to human arms races is close. It was familiar to Darwin, but not under that name. The phrase itself was introduced into biology by Hugh Cott in his Adaptive Coloration in Animals, which was published during the Second World War, which may be significant. I quote from Cott: "In the primeval struggle of the jungle, as in the refinements of civilized warfare, we see in progress a great evolutionary armament race, whose results for defense are manifested in such devices as speed, alertness, armor, spinescence, burrowing habits, nocturnal habits, poisonous secretions, nauseous taste, and procryptic, aposematic, and mimetic coloration. And for offense, in such counter-attributes as speed, surprise, ambush, allurement, visual acuity, claws, teeth, stings, poison fangs, and anticryptic and alluring coloration. There is an arms race between predators and their prey. When we see a beautifully adapted animal like a cheetah or an antelope, like a bat or the moth that it pursues, we are looking at the end product of a long arms race run in evolutionary time, when adaptations on one side are countered by adaptations on the other, and then counter-countered by adaptations on the first, and so on. The process escalates until you get animals with spectacular running speed, spectacular weapons, spectacular sense organs. The improvements that we see in an arms race are improvements in equipment to survive, not improvements in survival itself. And this is for an interesting reason. There may be episodes during which one side or the other in the arms race temporarily pulls ahead. But in general, improvements on one side cancel out improvements on the other. So there's even something a bit paradoxical about arms races. They're economically costly for both sides, yet there's no net benefit to either, because the potential gains on one side are cancelled out by gains on the other. Both sides would be better off coming to a sort of trade union agreement to call off the arms race. As a ludicrous extreme, prey species might sacrifice a tithe of their number in exchange for secure and untroubled grazing for the rest. Neither predators nor prey would have to divert valuable resources into muscles for fast running, sensory systems for detection of enemies, vigilance, prolonged hunts which are time-wasting and stressful for both sides. Both sides would benefit from such a trade union agreement, but unfortunately, Darwinian theory knows no equivalent of trade unions and no way in which they could possibly evolve. Instead, both sides pour resources into competing with their own side to outrun the other. Individuals of both sides are forced into difficult economic trade-offs within their own bodily economies. If there were no predators, rabbits could devote all their economic resources, all their valuable time, to feeding and reproducing more rabbits. Instead, they're forced to devote time, substantial time, to looking out for predators, and economic resources into building up escape equipment. In turn, on the other side of the arms race, this forces predators to shift the balance of their economic investment, again, away from the central Darwinian business of reproducing, and into improving their weaponry for catching prey. Arms races in animal evolution and in human technology show themselves not in improved results, but in increased shifting of economic investment away from other aspects of life and into serving the arms race itself. It's 7 o'clock, so I'm going to miss out talking about the cuckoos, which is one of a particularly spectacular example of the end product of an arms race. To the final point, which is that arms races are deeply and inescapably progressive, in a way that, for example, evolutionary accommodation to the weather is not. Adaptation to the weather obviously happens, but it just tracks the weather. If it gets hotter, you get adaptations to cope with hot weather. If it gets colder, you get thick coats evolving and so on. And as the weather changes, natural selection simply tracks it. But when there's an arms race, it's not like the weather, which is not out to get you. In an arms race, your predators are out to get you. And as you are evolving better escape tactics, the predators are evolving better catching tactics. And so there is a one-way arrow of directionality in the evolution in an arms race. The evolution of any complex organ in an arms race, like an eye or an ear or a claw or a tooth, has to have come about in a large number of steps of progressive evolution. How do we know there are many steps rather than just one? Well, that's elementary probability theory. The parts of a complex mechanism, a complex machine, like a bat's ear or a hawk's eye, could be rearranged at random in a million ways, more than a million ways, before you hit another arrangement that could hear as well, see as well as the real thing. It's statistically improbable, not just in the boring sense that any particular arrangement of parts is improbable with hindsight. It's statistically improbable in the sense that it's good, it works, it's efficient. Something so statistically improbable as that cannot sensibly be explained as the result of a single stroke of luck. It has to be evolved by gradual, step-by-step natural selection. And step-by-step evolution of a complex working mechanism like an eye or an ear has got to be progressive. It's getting better all the time. It starts out rather inefficient. The original eye probably could hardly see more than just a shadow, if that. and it gradually got better and better and better and better progressively. That's essentially my argument for saying that progress, which is what lies behind the predictability of evolution, is an essential feature of evolution, and the easiest way to see this is by thinking in terms of arms races. So my conclusion is that evolution is predictable not in detail, but it is predictable in certain repeated patterns. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. After that satisfactory round of applause, there's now time for questions. We've got 25 minutes or so for questions. A couple of ground rules, please. First of all, please ask just one question, one short question each. I'm sure there will be many questions to come. Please wait until you're handed the microphone by the steward. Unless you speak into the microphone, the people in the video-linked hall will be unable to hear the question. So please wait for the microphone. And when you get the microphone, please give your name and affiliation first. And Richard, you have to speak into the microphone too.
In the balcony.
Phil Ramsden from Imperial College. How much credence do you lend to Simon Conway Morris's views on the likelihood of hyperintelligent bipeds recurring in a Kaufman thought experiment? After all, we're more like bombardier beetles in terms of the number of times we in practice arose than we are like insects in general, are we not?
Well, as I said, I give more credence to it than most people do. I mean, it's a thesis which would instantly be dismissed by almost all biologists, and we tend to laugh at science fiction writers who invoke androids, as they might call them, and in life forms from outer space. And I would have laughed, but I must say I've rather swung round. I mean, I now think it's not totally implausible that there might be creatures a bit like us. There was a rather charming speculation about what, if the dinosaurs hadn't gone extinct, whether they might have produced a thinking biped. And there's a rather nice reconstruction or imaginary construction of such a thing. I forgot who did the construction, but the picture is in one of Wilson's books. I think it's on human nature. It's a nice-looking dinosaur. It's got hands with three fingers instead of five. It's got huge, great eyes, great big brain, stands up. Dinosaurs had already partway there in that they were bipedal, of course. Yes.
Tim Brassey. Do computer simulations of artificial life lend support or otherwise to your theory?
Well, not that I really got a theory, but artificial life is a very interesting, in my view, field in which people are putting to themselves the question, what might another form of life look like? In today's lecture, I've rather been talking about life as we know it on this planet. And so my reruns in Australia, South America, etc., all started from something like the same starting point. They started with mammals, they started with multicellular organisms using DNA as their genetic molecule. Essentially the same kind of life. What artificial life researchers are trying to do is to say, can we break right out of that box and imagine life as a much more general phenomenon? One way to do this would, of course, be to go to another planet and find another kind of life. Well, we can't do it. We almost certainly can't do that. We certainly haven't done it. So computers are a possible place in which we could run thought experiments, computer experiments, in which we are not limited to setting up life in the same way as it is here. We don't have to have DNA. Do we have to have some kind of genetics? I would think yes, but that's one of the questions that artificial life researchers might look into. Does the kind of genetics that we have to have, does it have to be digital, as DNA is digital? Again, my inclination is to guess the answer is probably yes, that a genetic system which worked by some kind of analog, perhaps some kind of blending inheritance system, probably wouldn't provide the kind of variation that natural selection could get a grip on. Would it have to be one-dimensional, as DNA is? Do the genetic bits or bytes or of information have to be strung along a one-dimensional array, as they are in a DNA molecule? Or could you imagine a two-dimensional matrix? Could you imagine a three-dimensional genetic entity? If you had a three-dimensional genetic entity, would it use the same system as DNA uses, which is a coded set of instructions, a kind of recipe or computer program for how to build a body? Or could we imagine some kind of Lamarckian inheritance, where the genetic entity, let's call it that, was in some sense a scan of the body of the parent? Because if it's a three-dimensional genetic entity, it could actually be a sort of model of the parent. Well, artificial life researchers set up all kinds of imaginary worlds, even with imaginary physics, because you're not limited to the physics of this planet, in which you try to get a natural selection process going, and you look and try to define the boundaries which life is limited by. How much of what we know about life just happens to be true of life on this planet? How much could be true on another planet or in a different rerun on this planet if you changed your assumptions? So I think artificial life is a very exciting field, and I recommend it to you. At the back and in the balcony.
Raphael Bossong, LSE. Well, I'm aware that the application of evolutionary theory to social theory is obviously always very controversial, but what would your comment be? Is this kind of view of evolution lending new credence to sort of socially views of social evolution, which are sort of, say, social Darwinism? You mentioned the arms race. I mean, isn't that strengthening the argument, which has been often sort of pushed aside, saying we can't reapply these models to social evolution?
Well, Darwinism unfortunately got rather a bad name in the social sciences around the turn of the 19th, 20th century because of social Darwinism. Darwinism was largely misunderstood and applied to human affairs in ways that, with hindsight, we can see were almost self-serving. I think John D. Rockefeller was one of the champions of social Darwinism, and he took the view that the weakest going to the wall was rather a good doctrine, and he rather approved of that in his walk of life. I saw a cartoon recently, almost certainly in the New Yorker, where an enormous, great, fat plutocrat of some sort was summoning a tiny subordinate into his office behind his massive desk. And he was saying, "I want you to understand, Smithers, that I don't believe in evolution, but I do believe in natural selection." I am very cautious about applying Darwinian ideas in the social sciences. Darwinism, in a sense, did get its fingers burned over social Darwinism. Darwinism is surprisingly difficult to understand. It's more difficult to understand than many people realize. Jacques Monod is credited with saying the trouble with Darwinism is that everybody thinks he understands it. There are difficulties of knowing, for example, what is the unit at which natural selection, what's the level in the hierarchy at which natural selection acts. You can get a kind of pseudo-Darwinism in biology if you imagine that natural selection chooses among species. And many people actually think it does. Many people explain altruism, explain reduced aggression by saying, well, species that fight each other wouldn't survive as well as species that don't. And that's a kind of species selection view. That's not the way Darwinism works. But when people try to apply Darwinism in very different fields, like the social sciences, they're apt not to realize that there's an important distinction between selection at different levels. You've got to know, or at least you've got to think about, the level in the hierarchy at which natural selection acts. In biology, we worry about, is it the species, the group, the ecosystem, the individual, the gene? You can make plausible or faintly plausible cases for a kind of Darwinism at all those levels. Only one of them actually works, and that's natural selection at the level of the gene. Well, when you move to the social sciences, if you're going to try to apply Darwinism, the very first thing you're going to have to do is to decide which level in the hierarchy of entities in society are you trying to apply it to. Are you, for example, talking about natural selection among nations? Are you talking about natural selection among business firms? Are you talking about natural selection among individual humans in a social context? Are you talking about natural selection among ideas? Is there a pool of ideas which flows around the human culture sphere, which you might see some kind of analog of natural selection, selecting good ideas and rejecting bad ideas, or selecting popular ideas and rejecting unpopular ideas? You can see that the level at which you choose to talk about natural selection makes a hell of a difference to the kind of model you come up with. That one could go on forever on that. I better stop, actually, and take another question. Yes, in the back there.
I'm Chris Knight, University of East London. I'm rather surprised by your answer to the last question, because surely behavioral ecology these days, when it means the study of, say, primate social systems, is a social science. Why try to protect the social sciences from intelligent, selfish gene Darwinism?
Well, behavioral ecology of non-human species is exactly, as you say, a social science. When you come to human social science, there is indeed no reason why one shouldn't use the methods and thought techniques of behavioral ecology in studying humans. Many people do. I applaud their efforts. It is, however, highly controversial, at least partly because there already is not just one, but several competing schools of social science who regard their territory as being trespassed upon. And so I suppose I was being unduly cautious. But while not wishing to arrogantly to import biological ideas into fields where people have been thinking in non-biological ways for a very long time, it is true that there are various flourishing examples of schools of thought applying biological ideas to human affairs, going under names such as evolutionary psychology, human sociobiology, human behavioral ecology, and these are well worthwhile. They're different from everything that I said in my answer to the previous question, because they are actually applying gene selection ideas to human affairs and saying, can we interpret the behavior of humans in their various different civilized environments? Can we interpret the behavior of individual humans on the basis of their being tamed animals who still retain the genes which help them to survive, which help their ancestors to survive, in what these people call the EEA, the environment of evolutionary adaptation, which might be Africa in the Pleistocene or more recently than that? So yes, a very worthwhile, praiseworthy field of study to be done cautiously, and maybe there is a lot we can understand about ourselves by applying biological ideas in a sophisticated way, interpreting what we do as maximizing our genetic success, not in the modern world probably, because most of us don't spend much of our time in the modern world maximizing our genetic success, but doing things which, or having a brain, having a psychology which can be interpreted as likely to maximize genetic success in the Pleistocene in Africa, but now showing itself in other ways which still have echoes of what it used to be like and still can be interpreted in terms of what it used to be like. It is a flourishing field. Look up books on evolutionary psychology. Well worth it. Yes.
Roman Katibi, I'm from a private consultant. Can you wait until you get your microphone, please?
Roman Katibi, I am from a private consultancy, and I'm really an environmentalist. I see that man has created arrogantly a mutual exclusivity with the nature and the environment. And I'm wondering, what will be the impact of man's arrogance on future evolutionary process of other species? I wonder if there has been any predictable prediction modeling in this respect. Could you please throw your thoughts on this?
Well, if there's been modeling, it sounds as though you're more likely to know about it than I would. If what you're talking about is the impact that humans are having on the environment, clearly it's dramatic and very large. It is deeply worrying that the effects that we're having are so large, widespread, unprecedented. When I say unprecedented, of course, there have been times in the past when there have been major catastrophes, but it can be argued that we are in the middle of a human-generated catastrophe. There's possibly something, some slight reason for optimism. Always in the past, when there have been these ecological catastrophes and mass extinctions, it's never been possible to predict, and even if it was, nothing could be done about it. There is something unique about humans, which is that we do have brains big enough to make predictions. We do have brains big enough to examine the world as a whole, instead of just our own self-interest. Examine the future from the point of view of everybody's future and the whole of nature's future rather than just our own narrow self-interest, which has never happened before in the entire history of life. In the entire history of life, there's never been such a thing as foresight, never been such a thing as prediction of the future, never been such a thing as taking action, which may be not obviously a good thing in the short term, but which is going to be a good thing in the long term. In past evolutionary history, there's never been anything but short-term interest being favored at every step of the way. Now, that's still going on, and it may be true of most humans that that's what they do, but at least some humans are interested in the distant future. At least some humans have the not only the ability to look into the distant future, but a kind of altruistic interest directed towards the distant future. So there might be some hope for the world. Humanity might not just be the arrogant enemy of the world, but humanity might, if we play our cards right, and that's exceedingly difficult to do, be the saving grace of the world. Yes.
Martin Nawrocki, UCL. I'd like to ask you, sir, if in such a theoretical realm of evolution, humans would have found themselves in a less threatening environment or in different geographical conditions, perhaps, do you think they could evolve such diverse forms of life, like marsupials in Australia, in your example?
If I understand you right, you're asking if there was a if the next catastrophe left behind in a virgin continent not rats but humans, would humans then evolve in, and become kangaroos and lions and things? Yes, I think they probably would. It's an interesting thought. Not quite sure how. I haven't really thought that one through. I can see problems with now that I do give it a second thought. I can see problems with that. There might be reasons why humans, the specialness of humans, especially with modern civilization, the specialness of humans might make it impossible for things like the necessary isolation of different populations to occur, which is essential, otherwise you're not going to get evolutionary divergence. So I think I better backtrack on my initial answer to your question. Yes.
Kyle Olson, King's College, London. You've alluded to the predictability of life evolutionary patterns, and I was wondering if you would ever plausibly lend any credence to a metaphysical or possibly a universal impetus behind these patterns. In other words, what sort of opinion would you attribute to what Aristotle would call a final cause? If you would attribute anything, how would you explain it?
I think the notion of final cause is one of the most unhelpful notions ever to occur to a human mind. It doesn't explain anything at all. What you need is causes that actually explain something, and that means causes that work from the past towards the future and build up to the phenomena that we see. The beauty of what Darwin did was he showed that all those phenomena which before he came along seemed overwhelmingly to suggest the need for a final cause, however unhelpful that explanation is. It must have seemed enormously tempting. What Darwin did was to discover a mechanism, almost remarkably discovered a mechanism, in which efficient causes that actually work in the past to produce effects, could make a world in which there were highly complicated machines which carry this overwhelming illusion of a final cause. That was Darwin's achievement. I think it's a great achievement, one of the greatest, if not the greatest achievement, ever to occur to a human mind. And to go back to final causes after that seems to me to be terribly retrograde step.
Richard, top right.
Yeah. Yes.
Cliff Chow, student at the LSE. Can learned behavior become inborn?
Can learned behavior become inborn? There is a theory going right back to the 19th century called the Baldwin effect. It was suggested independently by two or three different people. And it is a sort of theory whereby learned behavior can become inborn. One place where it's been suggested is in the evolution of snail smashing in thrushes. Song thrushes, as you know, feed largely on snails, and they break the shell open by finding a stone, which is called an anvil, and hammering the snail against the anvil. And it's quite a skilled operation. Blackbirds can't do it. Cliff Henty tried the experiment of teaching blackbirds to do it and failed. Blackbirds are very similar to thrushes, closely related, same size, same physical strength. If any bird should be capable of being taught how to smash snails, blackbirds should. But he failed to teach them. his conclusion, I'm not sure quite how sure it is that even thrushes, although it would have been called an instinctive behavior, snail smashing, even thrushes actually learn it. It's just that thrushes learn it so fast and so easily that you don't notice its learning. So the Baldwin effect interpretation would be that back in evolutionary time, an individual ancestor of a thrush was particularly good at learning, discovered the trick of snail smashing and did it rather badly, but learned to do it better. Others imitated it, perhaps. That's not a necessary part of the theory. Over generations, individuals that learned to do it best or fastest survived. Individuals with a genetic predisposition to learn, not just learning in general, but learning specifically how to smash snails, that genetic predisposition would have been favored by natural selection. Until nowadays, thrushes learn it so fast that it looks like instinct. Blue tits, as you know, an epidemic of milk bottle opening by blue tits, and indeed great tits, swept over England in the 1950s, and it's a skill that many blue tits learned how to do. Again, one could imagine that natural selection would come along afterwards and favour those individual blue tits who had a genetic predisposition to be especially good at opening milk bottles, until that too might become an inborn habit. The role of learning in this theory is to bring out into the open genetic variation which would otherwise have lain dormant, otherwise would not have been exposed to natural selection. There always might have been genetic variation among blue tits in the skill of opening milk bottles, but as long as there were never any milk bottles, that genetic variation could never have manifested itself. As soon as there were milk bottles, and more particularly for this argument, because they were able to learn to open milk bottles, and therefore the benefits of getting milk were immediately available in ways that they might not have been immediately available if it were just purely a genetic mutation causing a bird to open a milk bottle. Because of learning, there's a kind of amplification effect of the benefit of the skill, and that allows the genetic difference, which would otherwise have remained masked, to come out into the open and be subject to natural selection.
This has to be the last question, please.
Right. That one there?
Hi, Anthony Vincent at LSE here. I was wondering if you thought that some of the notions of predictability that you've been discussing about genetic evolution would also be applicable to memes and evolution and ideas and things like that.
Well, I've sort of, in a way, answered that in an earlier question. I can't really talk about predictability in mimetic evolution without first deciding whether there is such a thing as mimetic evolution, and I'm inclined to think that there probably is, but it may not be the be-all and end-all, probably isn't, of cultural evolution. So if you're asking about predictability, I suppose one could say, could I predict that what if we were to, obviously you can tell I'm thinking aloud, what if we were to experimentally to release into the memosphere a particular set of memes and try to track them, perhaps track them using the internet? Could we make predictions about which ideas would be most likely to spread and which ones would not? I took part in a little experiment along those lines last year when somebody in California suggested that the homosexual community had achieved a remarkable success in mimetic engineering by propagating the word gay, which now has become universal, and everybody knows what gay means, and you can more or less no longer use gay in its original sense. So the meme of gay meaning homosexual has spread exceedingly successfully. What these people in California wanted to do was to emulate the success of the gay community by inventing a new word for atheists. And the word they lit upon was bright. The opposite of which I leave to your imagination. The Bright meme was formally launched in 2004, and the fact that I gather many of you haven't heard of it suggests that it's early days yet, let me say. But yes, I think that would be very interesting to do that kind of experimental study of a sort of mark release and recapture study of memes in the meme pool. And the Bright experiment, maybe we should wait for another few years before writing that one off. Maybe there are some others that people would like to try. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we've had to come to an end when there were still questions to be asked. But those of you interested in continuing the discussion are invited to the senior dining room. That's the senior dining room on the fifth floor of this building. There you will be able to buy copies of Richard Dawkins's books, and you may be able to induce him to sign some of them. And there will be refreshments kindly supplied by his publishers, Weidenfeld and Nicholson. As a mark of our own appreciation, that is Darwin at LSE, we would like to give a present to Richard Dawkins of something that we feel Charles Darwin himself would have approved of. So we have bought in your name, Richard, charitable donations to maintain an English bluebell wood and restore a wildflower meadow, since these were habitats which Darwin loved and that were the main object of his research, or much of his research. Also, to provide a set of books to encourage a child to get into the habit of reading. And finally, to supply a family in the third world with a sack of genes in the form of vegetable seeds, which we can be sure that the plant genes will do their bit to help the family to remain self-sufficient in the future. So, thank you very much indeed.
I can't imagine a more wonderfully imaginative set of presents. Thank you very much for that.